Chapter 15. The desire for change had for some time been latent in him, and his meeting with Mrs. Leaf the previous spring had given it a definite direction. With such a comrade to focus and stimulate his energies, he felt modestly but agreeably sure of owing something. And under this assurance was the lurking sense that he was somehow worthy of his opportunity. His life, on the whole, had been a creditable affair. Out of modest chances and middling talents, he had built himself a fairly marked personality, known some exceptional people, done a number of interesting, and a few rather difficult things, and found himself, at 37, possessed of an intellectual ambition sufficient to occupy the passage to a robust and energetic old age. As for the private and personal side of his life, it had come up to the current standards, and if it had dropped, now and then, below a more ideal measure, even these declines had been brief, parenthetic, incidental. In the recognized essentials, he had always remained strictly within the limit of his scruples. From this reassuring survey of his case, he came back to the contemplation of its crowning felicity. His mind turned again to his first meeting with Anna Summers, and took up one by one the threads of their faintly sketched romance. He dwelt with pardonable pride on the fact that fate had so early marked him for the high privilege of possessing her. It seemed to mean that they had really, in the truest sense of the ill-used phrase, been made for each other. Deeper still than all these satisfactions was the mere elemental sense of well-being in her presence. That, after all, was what proved her to be the woman for him. The pleasure he took in the set of her head, the way her hair grew on her forehead, and at the nape, her steady gaze when he spoke, the grave freedom of her gait and gestures. He recalled every detail of her face, the fine veinings of the temples, the bluish-brown shadows in her upper lids, and the way the reflections of two stars seemed to form and break up in her eyes when he held her close to him. If he had had any doubt as to the nature of her feeling for him, those dissolving stars would have allayed it. She was reserved, she was shy even, was what the shallow and diffusive would call old. She was like a picture so hung that it can be seen only at a certain angle, an angle known to no one but its possessor. The thought flattered his sense of possessorship. He felt that the smile on his lips would have been fatuous had it had a witness. He was thinking of her look when he had questioned him about his meeting with Owen at the theater. Less of her words than of her look, and of the effort the question cost her. The reddening of her cheek, the deepening of the strained line between her brows, the way her eyes sought shelter, and then turned, and drew on him. Pride and passion were in the conflict magnificent qualities in a wife. The sight almost made up for his momentary embarrassment at the rousing of a memory which had no place in his present picture of himself. Yes, it was worth a good deal to watch that fight between her instinct and her intelligence, and no oneself the object of the struggle. Mingled with these sensations were considerations of another order. He reflected with satisfaction that she was the kind of woman with whom one would like to be seen in public. It would be distinctly agreeable to follow her into drawing rooms, to walk after her down the aisle of a theater, to get in and out of trains with her, to say why wife of her to all sorts of people. He draped these details in the handsome phrase "he's a woman to be proud of," and felt that this fact somehow justified and ennobled his instinctive boyish satisfaction in loving her. He stood up, rambled across the room and leaned out for a while into the starry night. Then he dropped again into his armchair with a sigh of deep content. "Oh, hang it," he suddenly exclaimed, "it's the best thing that's ever happened to me, anyhow." The next day was even better. He felt, and knew she felt, that they had reached a clearer understanding of each other. It was as if, after a swim through bright opposing waves, with a dazzle of sun in their eyes, they had gained an inlet in the shades of a cliff, where they could float on the still surface and gaze far down into the depths. Now and then, as they walked and talked, he felt a thrill of youthful wonder at the coincidence of their views and their experiences, at the way their minds leapt to the same point in the same instant. The old delusion, I suppose, he smiled to himself. Will nature never tire of the trick? But he knew it was more than that. There were moments in their talk when he felt, distinctly and unmistakably, the solid ground of friendship underneath the whirling dance of his sensations. How I should like her, if I didn't love her, he summed it up, wondering at the miracle of such a union. In the course of the morning a telegram had come from Owen Leith, announcing that he, his grandmother and Effie would arrive from Dijon, that afternoon at 4. The station of the main line was 8 or 10 miles from Giver, and Anna, soon after 3, left in the motor to meet the travelers. When he had gone, Darrow started for a walk, planning to get back late, in order that the reunited family might have the end of the afternoon to themselves. He roamed the countryside till long after dark, and the stable clock of Giver was striking 7 as he walked up the avenue to the court. In the hall, coming down the stairs, he encountered Anna. Her face was serene, and his first glance showed him that Owen had kept his word, and that none of her forebodings had been fulfilled. As he had just come down from the schoolroom, where Effie and the governess were having supper, the little girl, she told him, looked immensely better for her Swiss holiday, but was dropping with sleep after the journey, and too tired to make her habitual appearance in the drawing room before being put to bed. Madame de Chantel was resting, but would be down for dinner, and as for Owen, Anna supposed he was off somewhere in the park. He had a passion for prowling about the park at nightfall. Darrow followed her into the brown room, where the tea table had been left for him. He declined her offer of tea, but she lingered a moment, to tell him that Owen had in fact kept his word, and that Madame de Chantel had come back in the best of humors, and unsuspicious of the blow about to fall. As he has enjoyed her month at Ouchy, and it has given her a lot, to talk about her symptoms, and the rival doctors, and the people at the hotel. It seems she met your ambassadress there, and Lady Wantley, and some other London friends of yours, and she's heard what she calls delightful things about you. She told me to tell you so. She attaches great importance to the fact that your grandmother was an Everard of Albany. She's prepared to open her arms to you. I don't know whether it won't make it harder for poor Owen. The contrast, I mean. There are no ambassadresses or Everards to vouch for his choice. But you'll help me, won't you? You'll help me to help him? Tomorrow I'll tell you the rest. Now I must rush up and tuck in Effie. Oh, you'll see, we'll pull it off for him, he assured her. Together, we can't fail to pull it off. He stood and watched her with a smile as she fled down the half-lit vista to the hall. Ziv, if Darrow, on entering the drawing room before dinner, examined its new occupant with unusual interest, it was more on Owen Leith's account than his own. Anna's hints had roused his interest in the lad's love affair, and he wondered what manner of girl the heroine of the coming conflict might be. He had guessed that Owen's rebellion symbolized for his stepmother her own long struggle against the Leith conventions, and he understood that, if Anna so passionately abetted him, it was partly because, as she owned, she wanted his liberation to coincide with hers. The lady who was to represent, in the impending struggle, the forces of order and tradition was seated by the fire when Darrow entered. Among the flowers and old furniture of the large pale-paneled room, Madame de Chantel had the inanimate elegance of a figure introduced into a till life to give the scale. And this, Darrow reflected, was exactly what she doubtless regarded as her chief obligation. He was sure she thought a great deal of Easier, and approved of most things only up to a certain point. She was a woman of 60, with a figure at once young and old-fashioned. Her fair faded tints, her quaint corseting, the passementerie on her tight-waisted dress, the velvet band on her tapering arm, made her resemble a Art de Visite photograph of the middle 60s. One saw her, younger but no less invincibly ladylike, leaning on a chair with a fringed back, a curl in her neck, a locket on her tuckered bosom. Toward the end of an embossed Morocco album beginning with the beauties of the Second Empire, she received her daughter-in-law's suitor with an affability which implied her knowledge and approval of his suit. Darrow had already guessed her to be a person who would instinctively oppose any suggested changes, and then, after one had exhausted one's main arguments, unexpectedly yield to some small incidental reason, and adhere doggedly to her new position. She boasted of her old-fashioned prejudices, talked a good deal of being a grandmother, and made a show of reaching up to tap Owen's shoulder, though his height was little more than hers. She was full of a small pale prattle about the people she had seen at Ouchy, as to whom he had the minute statistical information of a gazetteer, without any apparent sense of personal differences. She said to Darrow : they tell me things are very much changed in America. Of course in my youth there was a society. He had no desire to return there. She was sure the standards must be so different. There are charming people everywhere. And one must always look on the best side. But when one has lived among traditions it's difficult to adapt oneself to the new ideas. These dreadful views of marriage, it's so hard to explain them to my French relations. I'm thankful to say I don't pretend to understand them myself. But here and ever I told Anna last spring in London that one sees that instantly. She wandered off to the cooking and the service of the hotel at Ouchy. She attached great importance to gastronomic details and to the manners of hotel servants. There too, there was a falling off, she said. No, of course, but people say it's owing to the Americans. Certainly my waiter had a way of slapping down the dishes. They tell me that many of them are anarchists. Belong to unions, you know. She appealed to Darrow's reported knowledge of economic conditions to confirm this ominous rumor. After dinner Owen Leith wandered into the next room, where the piano stood, and began to play Among the Shadows. His stepmother presently joined him, and Darrow sat alone with Madame de Chantel. She took up the thread of her mild chat, and carried it on at the same pace as her knitting. Her conversation resembled the large loose-stranded web between her fingers. Now and then she dropped a stitch, and went on regardless of the gap in the pattern. Darrow listened with a lazy sense of well-being. In the mental lull of the after-dinner hour, with harmonious memories murmuring through his mind, and the soft tints and shadowy spaces of the fine old room charming his eyes to indolence, Madame de Chantel's discourse seemed not out of place. He could understand that, in the long run, the atmosphere of giver might be suffocating, but in his present mood its very limitations had a grace. Presently he found the chance to say a word in his own behalf, and thereupon measured the advantage, never before particularly apparent to him, of being related to the Everards of Albany. Madame de Chantel's conception of her native country to which he had not returned since her 20th year reminded him of an ancient geographer's map of the Hyperborean regions. It was all a foggy blank, from which only one or two fixed outlines emerged, and one of these belonged to the Everards of Albany. The fact that they offered such firm footing formed, so to speak, a friendly territory on which the opposing powers could meet and treat helped him through the task of explaining and justifying himself as the successor of Fraser Leith. Madame de Chantel could not resist such incontestable claims. She seemed to feel her son's hovering and discriminating presence, and she gave Darrow the sense that he was being tested and approved as a last addition to the Leith collection. She also made him aware of the immense advantage he possessed in belonging to the diplomatic profession. She spoke of this humdrum calling as a career, and gave Darrow to understand that she supposed him to have been seducing duchesses when he was not negotiating treaties. He heard again quaint phrases which romantic old ladies had used in his youth, colon, brilliant diplomatic society. Social advantages. The entree everywhere, nothing else forms a young man in the same way. And she sighingly added that she could have wished her grandson had chosen the same path to glory. Darrow prudently suppressed his own view of the profession, as well as the fact that he had adopted it provisionally, and for reasons less social than sociological, and the talk presently passed on to the subject of his future plans. Here again, Madame de Chantel's awe of the career made her admit the necessity of Anna's consenting to an early marriage. The fact that Darrow was ordered to South America seemed to put him in the romantic light of a young soldier charged to lead a forlorn hope. She sighed and said, "At such moments a wife's duty is at her husband's side." The problem of Effie's future might have disturbed her, she added, but since Anna, for a time, consented to leave the little girl with her, that problem was at any rate deferred. She spoke plaintively of the responsibility of looking after her granddaughter, but Darrow divined that she enjoyed the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.